I want to spend a little bit of time looking at the few verses that were read for us in Isaiah 57. It's a great passage speaking of the greatness of God. This is what the high and lofty one says, who lives forever, whose name is holy. I live in a high and holy place. There's a great sense there in those verses of the greatness and the majesty, the splendour, the awe of God. And I want to spend a few moments looking at this aspect, this element of awe, of praise, of recognition of the greatness of God. And why for some of us it's so difficult. And certainly for me, often, getting a sense, getting a recognition and understanding of my relationship with God, a sense of awe, is not something that I easily live with. And it's made me wonder why. And I think what I want to do is to put it alongside a whole spectrum of things that are to do with admiration and enjoyment and appreciation of things. And across into appreciation and recognition of the greatness of God. It seems to me that what happens in the church is affected by what's happening in society outside. What's happening in the city. What's happening in our culture. And just to spend a few moments looking at that, it seems to me that the 20th century has been marked. How would you describe it? What kind of word would you use? Perhaps you might say that the 18th century was a century of enlightenment. You might say that the 19th century was a century of industry. Perhaps in one sense, the 20th century is a century of the commonplace. Perhaps we've forgotten how to admire. Perhaps, as we look around, we've lost a sense of awe. Look at some aspects of that. If you take, for example, the natural world, everywhere we turn, there's the opportunity to see, to experience, to touch that. The vast plains of the Serengeti, the thunder of the Victoria Falls, it's all there at the click of a switch, available on the TV with David Attenborough, the commentator. The brilliance of an Arctic sunrise, the geometry of a snowflake. It's all there in National Geographic photographs for us as we sit in the doctor's waiting room. It's all there. It's easy. It's commonplace. The natural world. Perhaps also the human world is no longer awe-inspiring. We no longer admire heroes. We've replaced them with entertainment celebrities. The paparazzi bring us photographs of the most intimate domestic lives of famous people until we know their every fault. Every heroic and unselfish deed inspires us to what? In our 20th century, to suspicion and not admiration. All the statues have been knocked over and smashed. Goodness and courage have been investigated, psychoanalyzed, and shown to be something which is actually perhaps a personality fault, a weakness. It seems as though there's nobody left to admire any longer. The world of art is no better. I can't play a note, well, perhaps two or three on a recorder. And yet I can sit at home, surrounded by a great cloud of critics and my CD player, and analyse and criticise and take apart this orchestra, that soloist. I can go and watch plays that other people tell me to watch. It's as though I'm rushing headlong into a tidal wave of stimuli, of artistic images, and there's never a moment to stop, to listen, simply to appreciate. The critics have taught us that it's naive, it's immature to simply enjoy, to simply be moved. The natural world, the human world, the world of art, the world of science, that seemingly has been stripped of its power to amaze us as well. Mathematicians have just kicked over the number 8, and why? They understand infinity. Discoveries in engineering and in electronics have progressed at such speed that we're no longer surprised at what the little black box can do. Nobody watches Tomorrow's World any longer. We're kind of suffering from innovation fatigue. It's all commonplace. And even the world of imagination has been taken over by Steven Spielberg. And instead of being awestruck by the images and the creativity, we somehow just watch for how the special effects are done. This generation don't watch Doctor Who from behind the settee any longer. And even the word itself, the word orb, has been taken down to nearest car boot sale and sold off to the Americans and come back as arson, applied to pizzas. It seems as though nature and people and art and science and imagination, none of these things can bring our late 20th century civilization into an experience of awe. It's not fashionable. Our sensitivities have been dulled. These things no longer stir up our emotions. They fail to inspire us. They fail to impress and to move us. 3,000 years ago, the psalmist took a walk out into the night, looked up into the sky, and said, "What is man that God is mindful of him?" 20th century people point up at the moon and say, "Seen it, done it, been there." The church can stand in the middle of that kind of culture and be a community of resistance. This church can be a place where it's okay to be uplifted by sunset, where it's acceptable to honestly and simply admire a good person's life. This church can be a place where people can be moved to tears by the simple words of a song, instead of pointing out the wrong notes. This church can be a place where our imagination is stretched and lifted up to the greatness of God. The church can be a community of resistance, a community where admiration and appreciation and being impressed and being moved to awe is okay. But what is it that becomes the object of our admiration? Christianity is not just about being awestruck, but it actually stirs up. What is it that moves us to admire, to appreciate? Where the 20th century values wealth, the church values love. Where the 20th century responds to power, we follow a servant. Sometimes we make a mistake and we carry our priorities from the world into the church. We dress them up in Christian language. I used to be impressed by military parades. Now I'm into spiritual warfare. I used to fight in the playground and shout, "My dad's bigger than your dad." Now I'm into cross-cultural evangelism. I used to love a good argument. Now I study apologetics. No, we're called to a different set of priorities. We're called to something quite different, to be impressed, to be awestruck, to be amazed by different things. What impresses you about God? It's paradox that gets to me. This mighty creator was also a helpless baby. This king is also a servant. Helplessness. The baby Jesus, he was wrapped in swaddling clothes, wrapped up in helplessness. As an adult arrested as a dissident, Jesus was wrapped in a false royal robe and mocked. Wrapped up in helplessness. In his death, he was wrapped in the grave clothes of defeat, helpless and broken. Have you prayed to the helpless God? Have you admired this Jesus? We stand in awe of such a great God who can also be so small, so near, so close to us. Isaiah 57. This is what the high and lofty one says. He who lives forever, whose name is holy. I live in a holy and a high place, but also with him who is contrite and lowly in spirit. Why does God live with humble people? Why does he choose the small people of this world, the humble people, as his companions? Because he also knows what it is to walk in humility. That's why he chooses such company. He chooses people who are like himself. He wants humble people because he himself is humble. He has taken the road from Bethlehem to Golgotha. He has been rejected. He has been undervalued. He has washed feet. He doesn't grasp reputation or fame. Our great God is known by his humility. Do you admire that? Do you follow that? Are you moved and stirred to awe by the quietness, by the calm, by the gentleness of this Jesus? Awe. Our great God. Verse 18 of Isaiah 57. God says of sinful people, I have seen their ways. This God who is so great and so humble knows what we are like. He's heard the words we say. He's seen the lives we lead. He's followed the thoughts that we think. This God who is purity has winced at the impurity of our thoughts. This God who is humble has seen the way we struggle for recognition and fame and promotion. This God who is vulnerable has seen how we hide from others. This God who sees the mark of divinity in every person has heard how we describe one another as eyesores. This God who gave up everything has seen our greed. He has seen our ways. How do you feel about that? Sometimes it seems easy to say sorry, to confess our sins, to feel contrite, to feel penitent. It's almost weak over our sinfulness. It's easy to see ourselves as imperfect and inadequate, and broken and hurting and failing. But sometimes, and for some people, that's a lot more difficult. And we have to say, God, comfort the afflicted, and afflict the comfortable. Sometimes it's hard to apologise to anyone, let alone God. Whether we are people who find it easy to be oppressed by our own sense of sinfulness, or whether we're people that find it easy to walk tall and we forget our marred and broken character, we're out of touch with reality. We're out of touch with the way that God feels, with the effect that we have on others, with the missed opportunities, with the wasted chances. What does God say about that? Verse 18. God says to the person who is in this situation. I have seen his ways, and I will heal him. God is in the business of healing. He's in the business, not of snuffing out our existence, not of looking at us with a frown of disapproval for the whole of eternity. God is in the business of loving us, of valuing us, of treasuring us, of healing us. Where do you need healing this morning? Is it that you've lost completely the sense of the greatness of God? It's an intellectual fact. I am 5'11½". God is big. I understand it as a fact. But have you lost the experience of awe? Does God need to come into that and touch again that capacity to be awestruck, to be gobsmacked? God is great. Where does he need to touch your heart and heal? Perhaps you've lived in the commonplace world too long and have lost that sense of the greatness of God. Perhaps you've forgotten what it is to be contrite, to walk in humility. God can touch that and begin to bring you into the possibility of hope and change. I want to finish by shifting the focus a little bit from us as individuals, because God is not only committed to us as individuals, he's committed to the whole community. And just as we're affected by the city and its culture as it comes in, so we can actually go out and affect the city. Not just be a community resistance that is closed, is safe and protective and different, but a community which reaches out and challenges others. David mentioned in the notices the vision, one of the aspects of that, which we need to test and explore and see whether it makes sense in our own self. One area is outreach into the city centre to make the most of being a city centre congregation. I want to tell you just about one other church in the city and what that little community has done to reach out into its neighbourhood. Not because that is the right way. They have done their thing in their parish. Perhaps we need to do what God is calling us to do in our place. St Paul's and St Stephen's in Highton Green. You may know that congregation. Some years ago, they joined together. Two church buildings became one fellowship. After some time, they closed St Paul's Church and all moved into St Stephen's whole time. A couple of months ago, they opened a community centre at the back of the church. £3 million worth of new building. It's beautiful. What have they done? First of all, they've already used some space at the back of the church building to build some single-person flats. They've addressed the problem of homelessness. The St Paul's building will stay as a shell, but inside it, they're working with the Salvation Army to put in some flats, to provide accommodation specifically for homeless people. That church is bringing healing into the sickness of homelessness in our city. Secondly, they spent a number of years developing a thing called a credit union. If you're unemployed, it's very hard to borrow money if the cooker blows up and you need to repair the cooker. About 150 people in the Forest Fields area save with a credit union when they can. And when they want to, they can borrow from the credit union and pay back at a very favourable rate of interest. It's a traditional thing, like the mutual societies, like the building societies began. It's a very simple way of people retaining dignity and self-respect, and yet dealing with the crises that come up periodically. Credit unions are easy to start. They work best if a number of their members are employed. That's a little bit harder in Highton Green than it would be in a city centre. The church is bringing healing into an area of debt and poverty. And finally, this community centre. £3 million worth of new building. Very attractive. And in partnership with Clarendon College, they've got training available in the building. In partnership with a task force, they've got specialist employment offices working. The space for a playgroup, the space for sports facilities, the space for wedding receptions, the space for lunch. They've got a training package with a kitchen. And people are learning catering skills, but they're also providing food to some lunch clubs for elderly people. They're building community. They're building opportunity and possibility for people in their parish. We're doing many things in our congregation. Many individuals are doing many things. It may well be that God is calling us as a community to do our thing, to take the healing that God is giving to us for others into the city. We need to pray and talk and think and challenge one another and see what it is that he's saying. This great God cares enough to give each of us something to do to bring his love to others. Let's pray.